Okay, this is Tracy Wilson. I'm interviewing John Allen in Urbana, Illinois.
2061 and Beckman Institute.
And it is July 9th, 2007. And this is part of the Campus Folk Song Club Oral History Project. Okay. Well, my first question, I know I sent you these, but I don't know if you've thought about them recently, but is how did you become interested in traditional music?
Well, I think Archie Green takes credit for this. I was interested in learning how to play the guitar, and that was mainly a social outlet. I was in electrical engineering, and I heard about the guitar, about the Folk Song Club, and I figured that would mean that I could play the guitar and get a group together and make some music. And Archie Green took young people like myself under his wing and taught them about the rigors of good country folk music. And when I came here, I didn't know anything about country music or anything. I mean, as far as I was concerned, a bunch of hillbilly music was below my liking, let me put it that way. But I didn't dislike it, but I didn't have any respect for it. But after meeting Archie Green and getting to know these old people that he would bring in, and I can't remember the names, but there was Frank, somebody or other, who played the banjo, and Big Joe Williams, and, you know, bluesmen, and Mike Seeger was here. Mike Seeger isn't quite in the same category, but he's certainly a very important figure in the folklore story. And a little teeny bit of information with me went a long way. I immediately bought Alan Lomax's book, which was pack-filled of folk songs, and I learned dozens of lead belly songs and bought a 12-string guitar and got very interested in the personal histories of the individuals involved. And as I was telling you a few minutes ago, when Doc Watson came here, I interviewed Doc Watson. And I was told recently that this may have been his first concert, because my girlfriend of the time saw him in Chicago. She just called me. I hadn't talked to her in 40 years, and she called me up because my father passed away, and she wanted to talk about that. And she told me that she had seen Doc Watson some years ago, and she went up and told Doc that she had seen him at the University of Illinois, and he says, oh, that was my first concert. So I don't know what role Archie Green played in discovering Doc Watson, but you'd have to ask Archie. I think that would be an interesting question, but Archie certainly played a role. But Doc Watson was such a spectacular guitar player. It was so clean and fast and smooth and wonderful that you couldn't help but instantly love it. And he loved the music, and he respected it and cared about what was going on, and he had family. Archie also knew Johnny Cash, and would talk about June Cash and the Carter family, and so he got us all involved through stories that he would tell and through his connections that he would bring to the University of Illinois with a very small budget. But you couldn't help, well, I couldn't help but be infected by his enthusiasm and his love for folklore. So I don't know if I under or over answered that question.
Okay, that's great. So how did you end up at the University of Illinois?
I grew up in Illinois, and they had, University of Illinois has a very serious reputation in electrical engineering, and I was headed for electrical engineering from the age of when I was in third grade. I told my teacher I didn't know if I wanted to be an electronic or electrical engineer. Could she tell me what the difference was? So I was pretty focused on what I wanted to do. And the University of Illinois is presently number three in engineering. And I think it was pretty good back then as well. So it's a cheap education of the highest quality.
So where are you from originally?
Batavia. Batavia is on the Fox River Valley between Elgin and Aurora. It's where Fermi Labs is, which is the accelerator, particle accelerator laboratory. Fermi Labs was not there when I was there. But I kind of grew up a Huck Finn, Tom Sawyer type of a life. I mean, not really, but we used to go swimming in the Fox River, and my mother, who is a loving soul and certainly cared about my daily existence pretty much back then, back in the 40s when I was born in 42, you just wandered around, you did what you wanted, and you go play with the dog or you go down to the river. And I had a gun and I used to shoot bottles, and I mean, nobody paid any attention. Today, that's not the standard, but back then, we all just wandered around, did whatever it was we wanted, climbed trees. People died. But it was rare for somebody to die, but it was a pretty loosey-goosey, freewheeling lifestyle.
So how did you become part of the Campus Folk Song Club? Do you remember first becoming involved with people who were attached to it? Or were you one of the first people?
They were mostly graduate students. As best I can remember, the ones I communicated with. Mm-hmm. So I had quite a few acquaintances. There was Bill Becker, John Walsh, mathematician. Becker, I'm not sure what he did. John Monday became a close friend of mine. He is in biochemistry. So it was a broad mix. There's a bunch of other people. Of course, Fritz Plaus. Oh, I know what happened. I was in the first group of people that lived at Orchard Downs. This is exactly what happened. It had to do with a stroke of rooming. Across the hall, I was rooming at Orchard Downs. It was the first... excuse me about my throat. It was the very first time they opened up Orchard Downs. It was built for graduate housing, but they had too many undergraduates, and so they filled us. They packed us in there and put a bus service on, and there were no trees. It was really primitive. It was a really awful place. And so far out. And across the next house, apartment over was Fritz Plaus and Jarvis. What's Jarvis Rich? Jerry Lazar. I don't think he had anything to do with the Folk Song Club. Were in that apartment, and Fritz and Jarvis were very much interested in the Folk Song Club and probably had been here for a while, and so they introduced me to it, and they played music. Fritz tried to play the fiddle. He wasn't terribly good at it, but Jarvis was pretty good at the fiddle, and he also played the banjo, and I played the guitar and the banjo and a bunch of other things. And so that became a fun... That definitely was a daily exercise of getting together and playing music. And of course we sang and played, and it was old-timey music. So Jarvis knew a lot of old-timey music, and he sort of passed it along to Fritz. Fritz is a pretty well-educated, pretty smart guy, so he probably knew a lot of it himself. But I think Jarvis was a key person.
Do you recall what year that was? Was that your first year?
That was 61, yeah.
You were a freshman then?
Yeah. And was here for that one semester, and then I decided to take my guitar on the road. So the second semester, I left school. My parents were pretty worried about this, but I was pretty clear what I was doing, and I went to France and hitchhiked across France and ended up in Barcelona, and then took the train back. I was there for, I worked in Kansas City for a summer to earn the money, and then the next semester, so maybe I was here two semesters. I was here for my first year at Orchard Downs. And then I left for the third semester, and then for the fourth semester on, I finished up. But I was always heavily involved in the Folk Song Club, mostly as a musician. I was president at the end of the tenure, and then I lived with Archie because he was leaving. He was leaving. Moving to California, I guess. And
was that in the 60s or in the 70s?
Well, that would have been in 66. Huh. It was either my second to last semester. No, it was probably in my junior year, because he got me out of housing. You had to be, if you were an undergrad, you had to be in student housing. But he went to the dean of housing or whatever, administrations, and he got me out of it and rented the house, the second floor of the house next door to his house, which was on Indiana Avenue. The house is still there. And so we had the second floor, and he moved in and I moved in. And then that semester, after he was there, he was finishing up what he had to do, but he wanted to sell his house, so he needed a place to live. So he took advantage of the situation. So then he left the next semester, and I got a whole bunch of roommates. He got one of the roommates. The guy was, a strange guy, but really brilliant. A graduate student. His room was just, you wouldn't believe it, such a mess. Couldn't walk across the floor. So I think I...
Yeah, so were there many people who took off and went to Europe back in those days? It seems like that must have been kind of an unusual decision. Did you know
probably
other people who did that?
No. Mm-hmm. Probably. Well, my mother was very much a traveler, and I'd been to Europe once at the age of 14. And so the idea of going to Europe was not foreign to me since I'd been there.
Right.
Going to Europe was a big deal back then.
Right.
Yes, definitely. That's true. So the number of people that packed up with their guitar and went to Europe was probably pretty small. But it was a good experience.
Yeah.
And I certainly played a lot of music there because I played on the streets of the Champs-Élysées and went up and down the streets playing the guitar and a banjo. And
And you play traditional tunes as well?
Sure. They love it.
Really?
Yeah. The Europeans are more sophisticated about American folk music than the Americans are. They see it as a bunch of hillbilly music, but the English and Europeans in general, especially, I mean, you certainly, I'm sure, know about blues. Blues in Europe is big, and jazz and some American musics are much, much bigger there than they are here. I don't know about today, because I don't follow it anymore. But back then, that was certainly true.
I think it still might be true.
Yeah. We just don't appreciate, like, the river music down on the Mississippi, you know, where, you know, I mean, not starting with Chuck Berry. I mean, he was a latecomer, but the Delta blues music that came up the Mississippi and went up into Chicago. Chicago is still North Street, still has a lot of that going on. The whole history of how that came about. Lead Belly and Blind Lemon Jefferson and these amazing people, musicians, who were the music. And in our, you know, I'm sure you know a million times more about this than I do, but RCA came in and recorded it all. Lomax played, I guess, played some role in commercializing a lot of the music. I heard an interview of Lomax on the radio the other day.
Really?
There was two Lomaxes, of course. There's a father and a son.
Was it with Alan Lomax?
What was the father's?
The father's John.
Okay, Alan. Yeah, I'm sure it was Alan. And it was a taped interview. I don't think WILL does that kind of thing anymore, so maybe it was WEFT. Mm. I'm not sure. Mm. I also listen to internet radio a lot, so. Mm. But I imagine it was WEFT.
What role did the club, the Campus Folks and Club, play at the U of I in the 60s when you were? From your perspective?
Well, it was significant, in my opinion. Because first, it was just a big social event, and that was one aspect of it. It was extremely popular. Joan Baez, I'm sure, had something to do with all of this. I mean, and Bobby Dylan, and there was a pseudo folk craze with the Kingston Trio leading the pack and many other groups, all of which I, of course, completely disdained. I actually have to admit I liked the Kingston Trio, and that was an early thing that we used to play, but after Archie touched me on the head, then it became less acceptable. But it was nice music, but it wasn't folk music. And Joan Baez was just such a talented person, you couldn't do anything but love her. And Bob Dylan, same thing. He's a very incredibly talented person. And I don't think they tried to sell what they were doing as traditional music, so you couldn't... Nobody was blaming anybody. But we certainly had our opinions about what was what we liked and what we didn't like. Doyle Moore was also a very important player in all of this. As a, he was a statesman for the music and a player, and just an incredibly all-around talented guy, active today. Do you have a copy of the record?
Their record? I don't have a copy. I've heard parts of it.
I have a copy of it. Yeah, he gave me a CD, which I was just playing the other day. It's a great little...
Is it available on CD?
Well, it's available from Doyle Moore. And he lives here in town.
Yeah, I interviewed him a couple weeks ago, back at the beginning.
Well, you should ask him to give you a copy of the CD, because it's wonderful music.
Yeah.
And it's a very, gives you a very good feeling for Philo. No, there's two, there's a record, and then there's the CD of the Philo Glee and Mandolin Society, which I presume that was a record too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was.
But, so, let's see, what's the question here?
Oh, I was talking about the role
of the club. Role of the folk song club, yeah. So first there was the social event, and then there was the intellectual aspect of it. The there was a pseudo political side to it, which I can tell you about. But for me, it was largely I enjoyed the intellectual. I'm sorry. My throat is bothering me. I enjoyed the intellectual side of the traditional folk song music, the people, the Frank Prophets, that was the name I was, one of the names I was trying to think of, the Lead Bellies. I got into the persona of these people. I was interested in who they were. And there was the social side of it, which was just a big social event. We had concerts every Friday evening, probably at 8 o'clock, and we'd fill Smith Hall or we'd fill the Lincoln Hall, Those are the two main places that we performed at. And I would frequently be the MC, or Fritz Plaus, or Jarvis. A lot of people played that role. Archie never was the MC that I can remember. It was usually the people who played would be the MC. And we'd have like 6, 7, 8, 9 acts that would get up and perform. And we'd pack the place. I mean, there'd be 1,000 people. I don't know how many people you can seat in Lincoln Hall or in Smith Hall. You can check on that, but we'd fill the place, no problem. So the word on the street was that there were 1,000 people there. And we'd put up little flyers around the campus, but it wasn't even necessary. They knew to come. I've never seen anything quite as popular as this. I mean, even Krannert has trouble getting audiences like that.
Right.
So part of it was the pure commercialism of popular folk music due to the Kingston Trio. So it was in at the time. It was cool. There was the anti-war aspect of things as Arlo Guthrie kind of attitude. So there was a lot of people who were anti-war, much more so than today.
Mm-hmm.
Than on the campus, it was really acceptable to be anti-war. Here it's still, it's funny. The students are just square as bears.
Yeah,
and then there was this important political side. The SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, were, I am told, very active on the campus. And there was a guy from Geneva, Illinois, and I can't remember his name, and he was extremely active in SDS. And he tried to get me involved in SDS. And I can remember feeling kind of guilty that I wasn't all that interested in doing it. I don't think they were militant at the time, but I think they later became militant. I don't know if they became militant on the U of I campus, because I was gone by the time that happened. I was in Philadelphia, and there were stormtroopers walking down the streets in Philadelphia, and riots. And I lived one block off of South Street in Philadelphia. 22nd and South Street was at the center of black neighborhood, and bad things were happening there. But that was a few years later, in 68. So it was building. So the Folk Song Club, Archie Green kept a very strong rein on it. He said, look, folk music, his style, parentheses, his style, folk music doesn't have anything to do with social, with politics. Which, of course, is completely untrue. Woody Guthrie? I mean, what a crazy thing to say. But he didn't want us getting and turning. He said, keep the politics and keep the music separate from each other, because he cared about the music. Oh, another thing that happened was that we used to go to IU, Indiana University in Bloomington, and they had the counterpart. They had their own folk song club, and apparently they were going strong too. And we'd have exchanges, and we'd bring up people from there, and we'd drive down and with a group of people and put on a performance. And I rode with Judy McCulloch and her husband one time to IU to do one of these events. So there's we had some interaction with those people, and I gave my banjo to a guy there, and he rebuilt, did some work on the banjo, and then I got it back, I think, a year later.
I'm hopefully going to be speaking with Neil Rosenberg, who was a grad student at Indiana at some point during the 60s and had some contacts with the Folk Song Club here and there. So I don't know if you don't recall him by chance. He's a folklorist, too.
There was a guy who went to the what's it called, the archives, mm-hmm. National Archives.
Oh, Joe Hickerson?
Yeah, Joe Hickerson.
Yeah.
Was he at IU?
I think he was at IU.
I think he was.
For a while.
So Joe Hickerson came here,
mm-hmm.
and he was friends, he was very friendly with Archie, and I mm-hmm. spent time talking to Joe Hickerson. He was an interesting guy.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Unfortunately for me, I wasn't a folklorist. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was interested in the people, I was interested in the music, the social, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
But when it got into the heavy-duty folklore, I stepped out. So somebody like Joe Hickerson, I really didn't have the depth to mm-hmm. explore this guy for all he was worth.
Mm-hmm.
And Archie was my close friend,
mm-hmm.
And he told me a lot of stuff, but I never read, I mean, he had a book, right? I never even cracked the book, so that was, I was too busy doing my electrical engineering, learning differential equations and things like that, but I cared, but not to the point where I was going to make it a career.
Right. Was there a rivalry between IU and Illinois, or not? It was pretty
not
amicable.
Not in my opinion.
Okay.
If there was, I sure didn't see it. Hmm. They were very, at the level that I saw, it was very friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know, you know,
sure.
about some.
Well, you kind of answered this question already, but maybe I'll just ask it, and if there's any other component that you think might be relevant. So, did the political climate of the 60s have an impact on how the club's members perceived themselves?
I touched on it because I remember reading the question,
mm-hmm.
and I thought about it a little mm-hmm. bit. So, yes and no. I mean, I can speak for myself,
sure.
and probably could. I'm sure you got this answer to this question from Fritz Plaus. He'd be an excellent person to ask this mm-hmm. question of. I'm sure he had something significant to say,
mm-hmm.
as would Roger Ebert.
Mm-hmm.
Who is our dear friend, as I told you before, over the phone. So, my answer for myself,
mm-hmm.
it's most reliable, is there was this guy from Geneva, Illinois, and he was really pushing on me to become involved in the anti-war movement,
mm-hmm.
and I was 100%, 2,000% behind the anti-war movement.
Mm-hmm.
But not to the point where I was going to be put time on it because,
mm-hmm.
as I said, my number one primary objective was to get an education. I spent an incredible amount of time playing music and being distracted, but I wasn't going to get a double or a triple distraction. So
mm-hmm.
I was sympathetic. There was no doubt that there were people who were interested in the Folk Song Club because they were interested in anti-war. Some people were interested because they wanted to hear the music. It was a nice social thing, and they liked the Kingston Trio, which we hardly represented in any way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were people who were interested in the political statement. Of the music. Some people were singing anti-war. I don't remember if Tom Paxton, I think Tom Paxton lived not too far from here or something. He came through here at least on one occasion. Joan Baez was here, but not for the reasons of the Folk Song Club. Earl Scruggs and Flat, you know, they came here. That was invited by the Folk Song Club. Anyway, so there was this political side to it, but Archie reached out and, in my case, was very effective in suppressing any guilt that I had.
Mm-hmm.
I felt something needed to be done, but I wasn't going to go standing around on the street corners and holding plaques and do that kind of thing because I needed to be studying.
Mm-hmm.
And I was already spending too much time practicing my guitar
mm-hmm.
and singing songs and that kind of thing. So getting a third avocation or vocation, third job, third responsibility was something I avoided. But I think there was a small percentage, you know, like maybe 10% of the people who were interested in some aspect of the political environment that we were finding ourselves in Vietnam. I don't remember exactly how active we were in Vietnam, but we were certainly in Vietnam, right, at that time. And people were just coming out of their shells and saying it's not right. It was right near the beginning.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe the impact that your involvement in the club had on you then and later?
It was quite influential because of who I was. It was when you come to college, it's a very growing experience. Mm-hmm. And I had limited experiences in life.
Mm-hmm.
I spent an awful lot of time in my younger childhood playing with radios in the attic and building electronics and pretty antisocial. Not antisocial, just asocial.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't antisocial, I was asocial. I was spending a lot of time trying to learn how to be an electrical engineer and do science in my basement, except it was in my attic. And I came here and got involved in the Folk Song Club and all the people and the hysteria, wonderful hysteria of the music and the involvement, and it became a lifestyle and a social thing. And knowing Archie was obviously special. I could be wrong, but I think I was special to Archie. I think he took me, in the fact that he chose me to be a roommate when he needed something. He appreciated me and he liked me. He came to my wedding. We invited him to the wedding and he came. So it had, Archie had a big impact on a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
He was a powerful guy. He didn't look powerful and he didn't act powerful,
mm-hmm.
but mentally he had credibility and he had a lot of punch.
Yeah. If there's one theme throughout all these interviews I've done, it's his influence on people. Really stands out.
And he had a I'm sorry about my throat, but he had a beautiful relationship with his wife, Luann.
Mm-hmm.
And that was important. So you could see a relationship that worked,
mm-hmm.
that was loving. And he'd take me over to his house and they made lentil soup, which I'd never had a lentil in my life. And they'd serve us lunch or dinner or something, lentil soup for dinner. It was a cultural experience. I never really knew any Jewish culture coming from Batavia, Illinois. I think there was one Jewish family in the entire valley. And I mean, it was different then, okay? There was a reasonable-sized black population in Batavia, not in the next town over in Geneva, but I always grew up very, very sympathetic to other cultures and socioeconomic classes. I was inclined to want to help them and be their friend, people's friend, regardless of race, color, and creed. And so when I got here and met Fritz, who was Jewish, I suspect that, I'm pretty sure that Jarvis was, a lot of people. This was 50% Jewish population. It was a very, very large number of Chicago Jewish kids came down here. They could get a reasonable education. Fritz was from Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
But so it was a cultural, it wasn't a shock because I wasn't shocked, but it was a cultural bath of mixtures. I mean, nothing like you would find today, let's say in New York City, but certainly a lot different than we were all used to. So this, and of course it was because of, if I could have come here and never experienced any of this, but being in the Folk Song Club bathed me in all these different personalities and mm-hmm. people. So it was a common experience that we all shared together, and it was exciting because it was popular. You know, 1,000 people would come to the concerts, and we had to put the concerts on and organize the program and blah, blah, blah. So there was a lot of activity, and I had some social relationships with wonderful young ladies, and that was very exciting, and they were kind of hippie. Won't go into the details, but it was, that was, there was at least three young ladies that I got heavily involved in with, who became good friends. I don't know where they are today, but I think at least in one case, Archie set it up.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And Fritz Plaus was madly in love with this young lady, but somehow she picked me. I don't know what was going on there, but Archie had something to do with it.
Hmm.
I remember that. But so that was also, I mean, when you're a young person and you go away to college and you start having some serious relationships, obviously. And that was all, so there was this social aspect to the Folk Song Club that was critically important. So did it have an impact on my life? You bet. And I think it was unique because it was, there were so many people and there was so much activity and it was orthogonal to what I was doing, which was electrical engineering. Mm-hmm. So it was a social interaction that was a real and deep and true, it was family. Mm-hmm. This was a family.
Do you continue to play and
No.
listen to traditional music?
I listen, yeah, but I don't play. And I have I listen to two kinds of music, basically, country music and classical.
Hmm.
My daughter, Elizabeth, whose picture's over there, she plays the viola, the violin, and the piano, and she plays classical music, but I've take her violin and play this, I said the guy's name, the father-in-law of Doc Watson. I mentioned his name earlier.
Frank Proffitt?
No. So he had some songs, and I can still remember a few of those songs. And Gaither.
Oh.
Carlson or Carlton.
Right.
Gaither Carlton. You can, if you go through, you'll find.
Okay.
It would be on Folkways Records. They have recorded all of that stuff. I don't know how you get a Folkways record today, but. And I had all of it on tape. I had a huge tape collection, all of which got tossed, unfortunately, including this interview with Doc Watson. So that interview exists someplace in some basement, stuck away, who knows where, because John Schmidt had a copy of it. I mean, it wouldn't be a very high-quality copy.
Right. Is there anything else we haven't covered that you think it's important for people to know about the Campus Folk Song Club?
Did you look at all their publications? I mean, Judy would know that mm-hmm. because she was probably involved in that.
You mean the newsletter? Or
There was a newsletter.
Yeah, the newsletter's been digitized recently.
That's
been digitizing a lot of Illinois material.
That's cool. Mm-hmm. So you have a complete set?
Yeah, somebody deposited a complete set in the library. Maybe Archie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's good. And you spoke with Judy. I think mm-hmm. this guy John Munday, Munday, he was very, very involved in the Folk Song Club. He was a president early on, and being a graduate student, and he was a sophisticated guy, he met his wife, I think, through the Folk Song Club.
Hmm.
And he, oh, the Mayfields. Did you talk to the Mayfields?
I talked to them by phone once, and I'm hoping to interview them in the next couple of weeks.
So he was good friends with them. Okay. Very good friends. There was this guy who played the fiddle. He used to be on the Grand Ole Opry. He was over in... Well, it's not important. I used to go over in... I can't recall.
I know you said you had an appointment at 10:30, and I don't know what time it is.
My students, it's with my students, it's 10 o'clock.
Okay.
We have a meeting with my group. It's going to be small today because people are away. But
right.
So.
I don't know. I mean, I don't have any other questions. If you don't have anything else to add, then I guess we're okay.
Well, it was 40 years ago, right? So what is your goal in doing this piece of research, and what do you hope to get out of it?
It's an online project that
yes.
I'm hoping to link to the University Archives webpage so mm-hmm. that it's available. There's at least one other oral history project on students from the Depression era, so this is kind of another version of that from the 1960s. And I just stumbled I'm a folklorist, and I've only been here since August, so it's a one-year kind of position. The library had me come in to assess their folklore resources, and they, you know, said, okay, well, you can do some other project, too. And as I was talking to people on campus, people kept mentioning this club and Archie Green, and initially it didn't sound that interesting, you know, a student club from a few years ago, but people kept talking about it, so I started digging, and I looked at some of the archival stuff that Archie had left behind, club, you know, notes for meetings and copies of Auto Harp, and it seemed kind of interesting. And someone I was interviewing or speaking with, a scholar on the folk revival movement, and he was saying, well, anything that Archie gets involved with becomes interesting, and I think that's maybe why it stands out from some of the other clubs on other campuses at the time, that it's... impact was quite different, I think.
So because of the Folk Song Club, I got to know several people who were significant. I considered them to be significant, and I mm-hmm. think the world considers them to be significant. Mm-hmm. And I got to know them reasonably well, mm-hmm. better in some cases than others. And there's two examples that I'd like to mention.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, because I was... just a little kid and didn't think of myself as being particularly anything
mm-hmm.
except, you know, in a blob here on earth. This was important to me to get to know these people. So the two people that come to mind are Doc Watson,
mm-hmm.
and I told you a story about him, and I'll repeat it, and Roger Ebert.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Roger I knew actually quite well. Because he used to come over to my apartment. I was on Green Street at the time, and we'd practice playing. He loved to sing Union songs, and of course he has this film festival here. And now he's not able to talk. So I saw him at the last one a few months ago. It was in May, but the year before. I had a nice conversation with him, and he thought of me as I was his guitar teacher, which, as far as I'm concerned, that wasn't the case. I wasn't his guitar teacher. I was his backup,
mm-hmm.
and we'd sing Union songs, and it was mainly his idea to sing Union songs, because Union songs weren't particularly my favorite kind of music. I
mm-hmm.
liked old-timey stuff, and he Union made, he liked Woody Guthrie type Woody songs.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, once was a Union maid who never was afraid, that kind of thing. And he wasn't a particularly good singer,
mm-hmm.
But he had style.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, did he care.
Mm-hmm.
And he is so articulate mm-hmm. that he could get up there and just talk. He was editor of the Daily Illini, the student mm-hmm. editor of the Daily Illini. He's in graduate school. He's just an amazing guy.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing guy. And then he went on to have this music, I mean the movie career,
right.
of course. And we'd watch him on TV and be impressed. And Fritz knew him probably too well, because Fritz became a little disenamored with with Roger. They were at the Sun Times together, and I guess they were probably was, I never went into the details, but Fritz obviously didn't have all good experiences, but I had all good experiences. And then this other wonderful experience was flying with John Schmidt down to Tennessee to visit Doc Watson. And so the two of us, he had an airplane. I assume he didn't rent it, he owned it. And we flew down there. It made me ill. It was a couple-hour flight at least. We left from Champaign, and it was rough. Made me learn, made me understand that I don't really want to become a pilot. But so we flew down there, rented a car, drove to Doc Watson's house, spent several our visits, went to see the family playing music together at some social event. They had a caller, they had square dancing, they had music. Doc Watson was playing. Doc Watson was playing with his relatives and friends, and that was just a really cool experience. And I remember his son. What's his son's name? Was at the house, and the son had a 22, and I had learned how to shoot in camp when I was a kid, and so we were shooting clothespins off the clothesline, okay, and I just had, he was shooting and shooting and shooting, and there was one clothespin, and he couldn't hit it, and I said, well, let me try, and on the first shot, I got the clothespin, which was just amazing, because it was quite far away, and it was a bit of a stroke of luck. And so I took my one shot and blew the clothespin away and said, okay, that's it for me. And but his son played a very good guitar, and then he died in a car accident. That wasn't too cool. But anyway, so that those were important experiences for my life's experience. So that was.
Thanks for including those. Well, we're probably almost out of time, and I probably have to go check my parking meter. So thank you very much for.